Before bathing, he would perfume the pool with the salts that he carried in 3 alabaster flacons. He did not bathe himself with the gourd, but would plunge into the fragrant waters and remain there for 2 hours floating on his back, lulled by the coolness and by the memory of Amaranta. A few days after arriving, he put aside his taffeta suit, which in addition to being too hot for the town, was the only one that he had, and he exchanged it for some tight-fitting pants very similar to those worn by Pietro Crespi during his dance lessons, and a silk shirt woven with thread from living caterpillars, and with his initials embroidered over the heart. Twice a week he would wash the complete change in the tub, and would wear his robe until it dried, because he had nothing else to put on. He never ate at home. He would go out when the heat of siesta time had eased, and would not return until well into the night. Then he would continue his anxious pacing, breathing like a cat, and thinking about Amaranta. She and the frightful look of the saints in the glow of the nocturnal lamp were the two memories he retained of the house. Many times during the hallucinating Roman August, he had opened his eyes in the middle of his sleep and had seen Amaranta rising out of a marble-edged pool with her lace petticoats and the bandage on her hand, idealized by the anxiety of exile. Unlike Aureliano José, who tried to drown that image in the bloody bog of war, he tried to keep it alive in the sink of concupiscence while he entertained his mother with the endless fable of his pontifical vocation. It never occurred either to him or to Fernanda to think that their correspondence was an exchange of fantasies. José Arcadio, who left the seminary as soon as he reached Rome, continued nourishing the legend of theology and canon law so as not to jeopardize the fabulous inheritance of which his mother's delirious letters spoke, and which would rescue him from the misery and sordidness he shared with 2 friends in a Trastevere garret. When he received Fernanda's last letter, dictated by the foreboding of imminent death, he put the leftovers of his false splendor into a suitcase and crossed the ocean in the hold of a ship where immigrants were crammed together like cattle in a slaughterhouse, eating cold macaroni and wormy cheese. Before he read Fernanda's will, which was nothing but a detailed and tardy recapitulation of her misfortunes, the broken-down furniture and the weeds on the porch had indicated that he had fallen into a trap from which he would never escape, exiled forever from the diamond light and timeless air of the Roman spring. During the crushing insomnia brought on by his asthma, he would measure and remeasure the depth of his misfortune as he went through the shadowy house where the senile fussing of Ursula had instilled a fear of the world in him. In order to be sure that she would not lose him in the shadows, she had assigned him a corner of the bedroom, the only one where he would be safe from the dead people who wandered through the house after sundown. "If you do anything bad," Ursula would tell him, "the saints will let me know." The terror-filled nights of his childhood were reduced to that corner where he would remain motionless until it was time to go to bed, perspiring with fear on a stool under the watchful and glacial eyes of the tattletale saints. It was useless torture, because even at that time he already had a terror of everything around him, and he was prepared to be frightened at anything he met in life. Women on the street, who would ruin his blood. The women in the house, who bore children with the tail of a pig. Fighting cocks, who brought on the death of men and remorse for the rest of one's life. Firearms, which with a mere touch would bring down 20 years of war. Uncertain ventures, which led only to disillusionment and madness. Everything, in short, everything that God had created in his infinite goodness and that the devil had perverted. When he awakened, pressed in the vice of his nightmares, the light in the window and the caresses of Amaranta in the bath and the pleasure of being powdered between the legs with a silk puff would release him from the terror. Even Ursula was different under the radiant light in the garden, because there she did not talk about fearful things, but would brush his teeth with charcoal powder so that he would have the radiant smile of a pope, and she would cut and polish his nails so that the pilgrims who came to Rome from all over the world would be startled at the beauty of the pope's hands as he blessed them, and she would comb his hair like that of a pope, and she would sprinkle his body and his clothing with toilet water so that his body and his clothes would have the fragrance of a pope. In the courtyard of Castel Gandolfo, He had seen the Pope on a balcony, making the same speech in seven languages for a crowd of pilgrims, and the only thing indeed that had drawn his attention was the whiteness of his hands, which seemed to have been soaked in lye, the dazzling shine of his summer clothing, and the hidden breath of cologne.